From Georgia Public Broadcasting, it's On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tiny houses are hot right now. The housing trend among Instagrammers, affordable housing advocates, and HGTV's tiny house hunters is now being proposed as a solution for homeless veterans. A Savannah-based nonprofit aims to have 24 residents safely moved into a village of tiny houses by the end of the year. Cindy Murphy-Kelly is executive director of Chatham Savannah Authority for the Homeless. And welcome, Cindy.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Is the tiny house project on track to open in 2018?
It is on track. After a long, slow process to get us on track, we broke ground last month, and the first units are being built at Fort Stewart. We have a partnership there with HBI, and so the first 12 will be built at the base, and the rest of the units will be built on site, a total of 72.
A total of 72, but 24 residents you think can move in by the end of the year?
Yes, that is correct. Two villages of 12.
So I've seen the plans without a lot of detail, because I know you've put a lot of thought into the best, most efficient, low-cost materials. How big are the houses?
The main homes, and that's 68 of them, are 16 by 8, and the four ADA-compliant units are 18 by 8.
So I know it's hard to get an accurate count of homeless population in general, but how many homeless veterans do you think are in Savannah?
Well, we actually do an annual count, and we count every one of them. And our most recent count, which was last year, 231 homeless veterans.
Mm. I'm sure you've seen other models for this kind of tiny house for veterans. Where have you looked, and what have you seen?
We actually looked at models around the country. There's a charming little book that has a variety of models for people interested in building tiny homes. We also spoke with a board member in Madison, Wisconsin, and they built some small tiny small homes. And we talked with some folks in Eugene, Oregon. And then we did a lot of reading research, because there's actually quite a lot out there about the movement and what's the best way to build and how do you think about this.
And Chris Stout is CEO and co-founder of the Veterans Community Project, which launched Homes for the Homeless, tiny homes in the veterans community in Kansas City, Missouri. Chris, are you with us?
Yes, ma'am.
So, Chris, your project was in the works for 2 years, but just opened up the door to vets this past January. Why did it take so long?
It took a while because we're a grassroots organization. It was just three vets that started this. We were given a piece of property, and it had no sewer and infrastructure for us to be able to do tiny homes within Kansas City limits. We had to make some compromises, and one of those were it couldn't be on wheels, you know, no septic tanks. We had to be hooked up to city utilities. The homes had to be on foundations, very similar to a traditional house. So it allowed us to build within our small footprint, but, you know, kind of accommodate to a normal home. So we had to bring about 1,799 linear feet of sewer to the property to make it happen.
So a lot of hoops to jump through. How much did the units end up costing per unit?
So just through our partnerships and you know, community support, our actual cost to build them is well under $5,000.
Wow, that's pretty efficient. So I'm wondering, you know, Chris and you, Cindy, you said you've done a lot of research on this. Why tiny homes instead of converting old buildings, schools, you know, buildings that aren't in use anymore for veterans?
So that was our first thought. We headed down that path. Tiny homes were kind of a second idea. One of our board members had suggested it after we approached the city to give us one of their empty schools, because Kansas City has 26 empty schools here. You know, that being said, when we looked at it from an operational standpoint, the cost, it just wasn't cost effective to repurpose a building like that. The other piece was, is out of the three of us that started this, we were working with vets every day. I mean, we're out there on the street doing outreach and engaging them. And they posed a question to us that was very relevant. Well, what's the difference between a building like that and the current shelters that are out there? You know, you still have your communal living situation, communal shower, that kind of stuff. You're not kind of giving them that opportunity to have that safety and that security and all of that stuff that they desire, and kind of removing those barriers to get them off the street. So for us, tiny houses were the option.
Cindy, what was the decision? What was behind that decision for your organization?
Actually, our decision was very similar. It was a very cost-effective model, and we utilize a housing-first approach, and we really wanted our residents to have a place where they can actually go and shut the door and use their own bathroom and cook in their own kitchen. And we felt that that independence and the permanence of the housing was critical. We also are hooked up to city sewer and water, and we have a big infrastructure bill that's actually contributed to the cost. But overall, it's a very affordable option, and we live in a community with a major affordable housing crisis.
Has there been any resistance inside of the community about having effectively a settlement of people who had been homeless right next door?
Yes. We actually found land two times before we settled on a third plot. Because initially we were going to do a small project of only 10 units in a neighborhood, and we had a lot of NIMBY, and so we made the decision to look for land that was a little bit more out of the way, still in the city, but our land is between a horse stable and public housing, and it also is a much larger piece of land than we had originally intended. So our little $200,000 10-unit project grew to $1.7 million.
Wow.
When you add the purchase of the land, 72 units, three clubhouses, and all the infrastructure.
Yeah, it's an expensive city to live in, as it is. We're talking about the development of tiny house villages with Cindy Murphy-Kelly. She's executive director of the Chatham-Savannah Authority for the Homeless, behind a project, the Tiny House Project in East Savannah. Chris Stout is also with us. He spearheaded a development of tiny homes for homeless veterans in Kansas City, Missouri. So a lot of homeless people stay away from shelters because of the security concerns, because there's often conflict or you're afraid of your stuff getting stolen. But there are also rules. You can't use drugs. You can't use alcohol. Of course, from your perspective, there are safety concerns. So are there rules for living inside of these villages?
We are a housing first project, and the rules are very limited. In that we don't allow an open flame in the units, just to protect the units overall. And we are a harm reduction model approach. And so we strongly believe that folks need to be stabilized before they can work on their issues or focus on quality of life. And as long as our local officers aren't upset with what's happening, we are pretty open to the lifestyle that our folks choose to lead. And we also really think it's important to treat folks as adults. Mm-hmm. We know some of our folks have challenges, but again, it's really important to work with folks when they're ready.
Yeah, from what I understand, especially among homeless veterans, what really helps is, you know, kind of 360-degree wraparound care, not just housing, but in many cases for PTSD or other ailments or medical ailments, treatment, active treatment. Is that something you can offer? Or let's ask you, Chris, you've been doing this for a while. Is that just one piece?
Yeah. So for us, you know, the tiny houses are kind of like, that's a shiny penny. That's the bait and switch for us, right? We get them in with that, and then the meat and potatoes of what we do is everything else. It's the group and the individual therapy. It is sending them to substance abuse treatment so that they can get taken care of. And to your earlier question, you know, we started out very similar. We're like, hey, listen, they're adults. They're going to, you know, we want to treat them as such. As long as they're progressing and moving towards permanent housing, you know, they're welcome to stay. However, what we found was, you know, veteran A, you know, their behavior was affecting veteran B. So I'm like, listen, we didn't stop the drinking altogether, but we said, listen, it couldn't be on the property. So we had to make some adjustments early on.
Cindy, how about you? What kind of services are you going to be able to offer in addition to providing housing?
We do have a wide range of wraparound services available. We are a direct service provider, and we are the lead agency for homeless services in our community, so we have many collaborative partners, and so we offer a wide range of services, and we have the capacity to build additional services as they are needed. Most recently, we've developed a street medicine program, and the Tiny House Village will be one stop on that program. So we are also a learning nonprofit agency, and as was mentioned, we know that we will have to adjust as we learn, but currently we're also managing 54 units of scattered site housing, so we have some seasoning with respect to working with formerly homeless folks, and we know that even with best intentions, sometimes we have to adjust what we're doing to make it a fit for all the residents.
Yeah, that can be a pretty big psychological jump for somebody, can't it, to have been on the street for a while and suddenly there's housing. I've actually heard of some people who have not been able to really cope with that.
And we do anticipate that some folks will not be able to already with veterans that we work with in our 22 homeless camps and our emergency shelters. We have a couple of those veterans that we have housed, and in one case, one individual twice. And this particular veteran is simply unable due to PTSD and other issues to maintain the housing. So our primary goal is to keep folks in housing, but we know for some it's going to really be a challenge.
And Cindy Murphy Kelly, the settlement in East Savannah, is that open only to veterans?
It is. The donors that have provided all the support for the project, private donors, businesses, no government money at this point, it is restricted to serving homeless veterans.
Chris, I'm thinking that you watched as veterans moved into, formerly homeless veterans moved into these tiny houses in Kansas City. What was that like to watch them take up residence?
Well, so we're a very small project here. So we started building those homes, those first 13 homes we have. We built those, we started those on Christmas Eve. And we completed those in about 31 days. And so when I say we, I mean we, the founders, like the three of us that started this, were out there till about 2 a.m. every day. So for us, on January 31st, when we had that big ribbon cutting thing, and we actually were able to invite the vets in to see the homes for the first time, you know, and the looks on their faces, you know, because a lot of these guys came straight out of the shelters or were in their cars. And for me, it just, it made all that work worthwhile, you know, because, you know, we spent the last two and a half years working about 100 hours a week, you know, putting together houses and raising money and, you know, kind of making this happen for these guys. And to have the most grateful, you know, and humble group of people moving into these homes, it was absolutely worth every bit of it.
Chris Stout, CEO and co-founder of the Veterans Community Project in Kansas City, thank you.
Thank you.
And Cindy Murphy Kelly, she's executive director of the Chatham Savannah Authority for the Homeless. It's the nonprofit that is creating tiny homes for homeless veterans in Savannah. Cindy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
For more on the project, go to gpbnews.org. Just ahead, it's a long way from Peru to the U.S. An author looks back at her family's migration and life in America. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. A few weeks ago, we talked about mental health issues in immigrant communities. I spoke to a young college student who had been shielded from deportation through the DACA program. Listener Nuri Castillo Crawford of Gwinnett County got in touch after hearing it. Turns out she wrote a book this year about her experiences of coming to this country as a young child from Peru. It's called 3,580 Miles to Be an American Girl. These days, Nuri is director of community engagement at Gwinnett County Public Schools. And now she's changing 10-year-old Jada Sanford's life. Though Jada was born in the U.S., she's about the same age Nuri was when she arrived in this country. Nuri's book about her experience as an immigrant has shaped Jada's perspective. The two of them recently stopped by our studios and spoke with On Second Thought's Fenley Foxen.
My initial experience was literally landing in Indianapolis, Indiana. That's where the airport was. And coming into the airport and walking outside and immediately feeling like my life had just been turned upside down.
Well, I'm going to bring Jada in at this point. Why did you like this book?
I liked the book because it was talking about how people from South America came to the United States, and their lives were better here than they were in Peru. And it talks about how they came in luggage, but they had only luggage, and how when they came here, how when they went to school, they didn't know anything. They didn't know any English. They didn't. They only spoke Spanish, and there were no Spanish classes to do translation, so she had to pick up English really quickly.
Now, your sister seemed to have a tough time at school, and you mentioned it very briefly in the book. Take us through what happened to her at school.
She did have an enormous transitional challenge ahead of her. I remember her crying the very first time my parents tried to put us on the bus. Because at that time, my parents did not have a car or transportation, and we lived in the country. So it wasn't like we were in the city and we could take, you know, they could get on the bus, the, you know, public transportation and drop us off or anything. So they put us on the bus, and my sister held on to my mom's leg, and she was crying. My mom was crying. My uncle was trying to force her out of, you know, like, get your hands off your mom and get on the bus. And the bus driver was, you know, remarkably very patient and just waited there. And the kids were all like on the bus looking. I looked up and I see all these little, there were no brown children. So it was all these little white kids looking at me and my sister having a fit and finally getting on the bus. And of course she was assigned a seat next to mine. And right before I would board, my mom would just, you know, squeeze my hand and tell me to be brave. And she'd say, "You don't get to cry. You know, you don't cry," because I think she could see in my face that I was about to lose it. So she would be like, "You don't get to cry. You need to be brave and get on the bus, take care of your sister." And then we'd get to school. Sometimes it would be a huge ordeal to try to get my sister away from me at school so it wouldn't end, you know, at the bus stop. And then the principal would try to get her off first and then me, and then they would shoo me away, like, go to the, you know, like, go to another way inside the building so they could immediately separate us. And when they did that, which was most of the time, she would immediately within the first hour or two, you know, be lost within the school. The principal would come around. I could see her walking around and looking inside the window and kind of like signaling to me with her finger to come so that she...
Well, she didn't speak English, so she didn't know where she was supposed to go.
No, she didn't speak English, and nobody spoke Spanish. ESOL was not in place. I mean, by law, now that I'm an adult and I looked it up, of course, I see that the federal government had passed it. But when anything happens on the federal level, it takes time to disseminate and to implement at local school levels. So obviously, it wasn't a priority or a need, not being mean, I'm sure, or anything. It's just like there's only two girls that don't speak English in our district, and we're not going to sit here and spend money trying to implement a program for two girls.
Yeah. At what point did you feel like you fitted in?
They put me in a teacher's class, and one day she probably felt bad for me because I remember literally sitting there with the math book. And really any book in any class, just sitting there and kids turning pages, the teacher's talking, I don't even know what they're saying. And I start looking around and seeing, oh, okay, they're on page, what, you know, 84 or whatever. And then I would turn to that page. And so I remember, I think she just probably felt bad for me. And that one day she came in and we started class and she divided the class into three groups. And I went where I was supposed to go because I saw the kids going. And then kids would come up one by one and do like a race, three kids on the board. She'd call out a math problem and the kids would race to see who would complete it first. Mm-hmm. And I went up and I, in my head, I'm like, I don't even know why I'm up here. You know, like I'm looking around like, oh, it's going to go like every other time. They're going to say some things and I'm going to stand here looking dumb and then I'm going to go back to my seat. But that day she surprised me. She said the problem all in English. So the other two kids literally got started and I'm going through my thought process. And then all of a sudden with her, you know, accent and everything, but I was still so happy to hear it. She started saying the problem in Spanish. And I like did a double take, like, I'm like, what is she saying that in Spanish? And I see this, you know, little tattered Spanish English dictionary. And she looked up and smiled at me. And I was like, oh, my God, like, I'm about to kill this problem because I know what to do. And so I think the other kids were shocked to hear her speaking in Spanish. And they were like looking. So they stopped working on the problem. And so I went to town and I finished it and everybody started clapping. And that moment was wonderful and it's impactful, but it was like one tiny slither of a slice of the pie of my whole journey that first year with so many things and so many responsibilities. But so I don't remember her name, but that moment did make me feel like I could believe in myself again. And as an educator, I've tried to provide those moments with kids daily.
Jaden, do you have students in your class right now that you can think of that don't speak English?
Yes.
Oh, you do. How do you relate to them? How do you speak to them?
Well, I'm trying fluent Spanish. I am.
Mm-hmm.
And to translate to them, sometimes I'll have like, it's kind of difficult. Like sometimes I'll have, sometimes I'll look at some things and it'll tell me like, it'll translate the word in English,
mm-hmm.
but sometimes it can translate the word in Spanish too. So I sometimes will say the Spanish word to them.
So Nuri, in your book, you say your mom looks sad. And there's a picture of her sitting by the window with her head down.
She didn't have anybody to talk to and she was very alone and lonely. And of course, as an adult, I'm sure she knew the reality of where we were. Like literally we are here. We don't have any money. We don't speak the language. So I'm sure that was very hard for her to know that she's got three little kids that she and my dad were responsible for and would try not to show us that we were in a serious situation. But I could tell in her face that she was sad, you know, and so it made me feel like I had to do better so that she wouldn't, like I would be one reason she wouldn't have to be sad about or be upset about or worried about.
And Jada, one last question to you. What is your favorite picture in this book and why?
My favorite picture would have to be the ending picture of when she is, when at the end of the book, when she's standing in the grass and the sunlight's beaming on her face, because it looks like she finally found a place that she is going to fulfill her dreams and that she is going to be happier and more successful.
Nuri and Jada, thank you so much for your time. That was awesome.
Thank you.
That's On Second Thought producer Fenley Foxen speaking with author Nuri Castillo Crawford. Nuri is author of the book 3,585 Miles to Be an American Girl. She now works at Gwinnett County Public Schools. We also heard from her mentee, Jada Sanford. Today we're adding two more songs to our Georgia playlist. We ask artists to pick them, and the rules are pretty simple. All tunes have to be written or performed by a Georgian, and artists can't pick their own songs. Vanessa Briscoe-Hay is former frontwoman for the legendary Athens band Pylon. She's now singing with the Pylon Reenactment Society, and here are her picks for our Essential Georgia playlist.
Hi, this is Vanessa Briscoe-Hay. I'm speaking to you from Athens, Georgia, and I'm the singer for Pylon, Supercluster, and now Pylon Reenactment Society. Today, my first pick for the Georgia playlist is one of my favorite songs from 1968. It's by the Classics Four, and it's called Spooky.
First you say no, you got some plans for the night, and then you stop and say,
spooky little girl like you. what you've got is you've got a band who's telling a story about a spooky little girl like you in 3 minutes. It has a really nice kind of jazzy, bluesy bottom to it. It kind of snakes around and twists in there. The saxophone is very important. There's a, I guess it's maybe a progenitor of what became soft rock. Spooky is a very appropriate name for the song.
Love is kind of crazy with a spooky little girl like you.
The song itself was actually taken from a jazz standard, and some members of the Classics Four had decided to add lyrics to it. It started out as a jazz saxophone, kind of bluesy kind of song, and then when you hear the song, you'll hear the lyrics as it's playing, but it kind of appealed to me as a kid because it was talking about a girl who was a little bit different. Spooky little girl like you. Spooky. My second pick for the Georgia playlist is from 1978 by Atlanta's own The Brains, and it's called Money Changes Everything. It goes out to my dear friend, Margaret Adams. You know, it kind of represents what Atlanta was about at the time. It's very poppy, very well written, and synthesizer driven. Tom Gray released this initially as a single, and on the basis of the single, The Brains were signed to Mercury Records. This is just like a perfect pop song. They're like at the top of their game. The instruments are all very together, very professional sounding, which was maybe more of a hallmark to an Atlanta sound than Athens. I mean, there were a lot of bands that never really got signed or moved beyond the area. The Brains were one of the ones who did. When you hear a really good pop song like that, you realize what makes it tick. And to me, the clearness of the lyrics and the sentiment really come through. It's a just very punchy, very hooky pop song. I don't know that Pylon were ever accused of being very hooky or punchy or any of that. We were maybe left field from that. But I can say that I enjoyed that, and I had many friends in Atlanta who were associated with that band.
singer Vanessa Briscoe-Hay with Athens group Pylon Reenactment Society. The group performs next month at the Irrelevant Music Festival in Atlanta. Details at gpbnews.org. Just ahead, more music with Liz Brasher. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Next week, author Flannery O'Connor's home, Milledgeville, reopens to the public. We're going to hear about the restoration process on tomorrow's show and reflect on her legacy. But first, we want to hear from you. What is your favorite Flannery O'Connor work? Does seeing where an author or an artist lived or worked make you think of them differently? You can leave us a voicemail at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter and Facebook at OST Talk. And then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. My next guest has turned Southern gospel music every way but loose. I pulled my roots out for you. Shoulders around. I didn't want to be found when you shine so bright. Babe, you block my light. Singer and musician Liz Brasher calls her music garage rock meets Delta blues meets gospel meets soul. She grew up singing in a North Carolina Baptist church choir in Spanish and later soaked up the scene in Atlanta. She now lives in Memphis. Liz Brasher is on tour for her newest EP. It's called Outcast, and she's on her way into Georgia next week. Liz, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So that song we just heard, Come My Way, one of the lyrics, I pulled my roots out for you. I'd love to know a little bit more about your roots.
Yeah, so I'm actually first generation U.S. My mom and her family are from the Dominican Republic, and my father is Italian. And I was born in Matthews, North Carolina, born and raised there in a Southern Baptist Spanish-speaking church.
So you were singing Baptist hymns in Spanish?
That's right, yeah, and modern contemporary Spanish songs as well.
Do you remember any? I mean, did any come, did it float through your head that you were singing as a kid?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Let's see. Cuando fue a la cruz, mi Jesús, yo vi. Lots of little hymns like that just come in and out.
Beautiful. Is that how you discovered you could, like, belt it out your voice in church?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I stuck out from everybody else singing, and it was kind of oppressed for a little while until I discovered Southern gospel music and specifically African-American gospel music.
Oh, wow. So I imagine they just pointed to Liz and said, okay, you're on the solo today.
Yeah, that's where I got my start soloing for sure.
Well, a lot of Southern artists came up singing in the church. And for you, African-American gospel, that's an old school form of music. How did you make it yours?
Yeah, well, I actually lived in Chicago for a little bit, and I got introduced to the Delta blues when I was living there. And it made me study Southern music, and specifically, you know, gospel music and the Delta blues went hand in hand. So when I got to gospel songs, I just felt that that was, honestly, that was a true soul music form, and it it hit my soul more than anything had. And so I just delved in from there, and I realized it actually went hand in hand with the history of the South that I was also learning more about being away from it.
Hmm. Well, let's hear a little bit of that voice of yours. This is from the single called Body of Mine.
Lights go dim in these cells of mine. Change to the next.
This is my guest, Liz Brazier. So I love what you said about the Delta blues and gospel going hand in hand. That's, you know, the old saying that you're in the bar on Saturday night and in the church pew on Sunday morning.
Right.
Well, was it like that for you? I mean, I think you came from a pretty devout family.
Yeah, I came from a very devout, very legalistic family. And it wasn't until I went out of the South that I realized, you know, that not everything has to be represented in that way. So I started realizing that, honestly, at its core, gospel music and the Delta blues, they speak about the same things, which is a cry for help and a cry of resiliency as well.
Hmm. So was your family supportive when you talked about getting into the music business?
So it's crazy because I come from a family of singers. There are 9 siblings that my mom has. They all sing very well, extremely well. That's how I learned how to sing. And from a young age, I was singing and also taking piano lessons. But anything outside of the church was deemed, secular and of the devil. So, no, it wasn't supported.
Well, I hear a little bit of the devil in your music. Is that safe to say there's a little bit of a bad girl in there?
Well, I think I've always been a rebel, and that's because when you're raised in such a strict context, I feel like you naturally want to push those boundaries and push those limits. So I did that a lot. I was a very bad teenager. I've sort of reconciled that with just being human nature. It's, you know, it's a struggle between what's right and what's wrong every day.
Yeah, I think there's a song lyric I'm remembering. I was listening a lot in the last couple of days. You want me to behave, I'm going to misbehave. I'll behave when I'm in my grave.
Yeah, that's like a really good one.
Sounds like a rebel.
Yeah.
Well, that single that we just heard from, Body of Mine, this is something that NPR Music premiered on All Songs Considered, and they've given you a lot of love for this and for your new EP, which is called Outcast. Now, this is Outcast with a C, right? You know, you're not like that other Atlanta band.
not the Atlanta band, although I probably could have sold more records that way.
So now you live in Memphis. Now, it's funny to me, not Nashville, where 97% of musicians seem to live now, but Memphis, where there's a really strong appeal of soul music along with country. Was that why you settled there?
Well, I think this all goes back to me just constantly going against the grain and being a rebel. You know, wherever I see the masses forming, I kind of shy away from that. And when I got to Memphis for the first time, I actually felt like there was just something very unique and very honest and raw about the city, because it doesn't have to go through a filter of the industry. It's just musicians and studios functioning. And that really appealed to me because I felt like it would be a safe place for me to creatively form songs.
Yeah, there's a lot of duality there, too. It sort of maybe mirrors your life. This is the home of Stax Records, but it's also the home of Sun Records. Have you been and visited those places?
Absolutely. I try to go as much as I can, because to me, those are just between those two and the Mississippi River. It's like it's holy ground.
Well, Rolling Stone magazine named you one of the top 10 country artists you need to know. Now, would you consider your music to be country?
No, I think they had to put it in that context because Americana and country get lumped together. And Americana is a great representation of roots music. And I think more than anything, that's what I do, is I just try to represent music from America in general.
So what do you think of this kind of strict idea of what country is or new country?
Oh, I have so many opinions on that.
Well, this is what you're here for, Liz. So it's time to spill them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm honestly not a fan of new country. I am a fan of old country, to, you know, the songwriting and the storytelling that people like Johnny Cash and Loretta Lynn and Dolly Parton, Waylon Jennings, Buck Owens, all of the songs that they formulated. And there are new country artists that are doing things on a great scale. But as far as what's making, you know, the country radio stations go, that sounds more like pop music to me, like something that's just going to fade pretty fast.
I'm speaking with Liz Brazier. She's on tour for her latest EP, which is called Outcast, and she's going to be in Atlanta on June 17th at the City Winery. Well, let's hear a little bit more of your music. This is a song, Painted Image, and it was added to Spotify's Fresh Folk playlist.
Will you take our givenness? This is how it is.
try to live with your voice in my head. But all that I amount to is this: a painted image. No.
Painted Image, your first big hit single along with Cold Baby. I'm curious about the inspiration behind that song.
Painted Image is really about just us. It's like a self-reflection. So it's just a cry of, you know, not wanting to do what somebody else wants you to, but really just observing yourself as like this piece of work, because I think that's what we all are at the end of the day.
Well, I think also in the music business, image is a big part of it. Do you feel like, you know, you're almost like an illustration of the melting pot, right?
Yeah,
you're half Dominican, half Italian. Your stepfather, I think, was Jamaican, grew up in North Carolina, speaking Spanish. What does that feel like to you? Do you feel like you're forced to project something about who you are as a singer and a musician?
I don't, up to this point, I don't feel that way. Honestly, I feel like it's a huge benefit for me, because I feel like I'm able to show, you know, this nation right now that there's not one way to be an American, and there's not one way to be a woman in this industry, that it's very fluid and that it is very diverse. And I like that.
Well, this is some of the stuff that I think comes up in your lyrics. A little bit of heartbreak, or a lot of heartbreak, a little bit of sass, I think. But also, I hear some more bigger issues. Do you feel like your music is a place for you to express that, your feelings about, you know, being in America at this point?
I do. And, you know, my hope is that it will constantly give me a platform to be able to speak about things that are important to me, such as, you know, immigration and how women are treated in this industry and pay gaps and things like that.
How old were you when you first picked up a guitar? Because you do play, right?
I do play.
Yeah, so you're in this little tiny band, and I hear your live shows are amazing.
Yeah, I actually just picked up the guitar when I was 20 years old, so not that long ago.
Wow, so you're what, 27 now, 28?
I am, yes, 27.
Wow, so... young babe on the road in the world. And this fall, you're going to be heading back on a West Coast tour with the Zombies. These are Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominees. How does it feel to be opening and touring for a band like the Zombies with
such
a long legacy?
So they're one of my favorite bands. So honestly, when that phone call came in, my manager and I were in LA, and I could hear her reaction, and I just freaked out, because I knew what was coming, that I was finally getting the news that it came through. And it's pretty remarkable, honestly.
NPR did write that you should open for Betty LeVette, Justin Timberlake, or the Mavericks.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
So, yeah, what's funny is I've actually already opened for the Mavericks, like, very soon after that article came out, which is pretty remarkable. And then we met Betty LeVette's booking agent, who wants us to do a show together sometime soon. So we're working on Justin, but, you know, there is the Memphis connection, so we'll see.
Who would you absolutely love to open for?
Oh, at the top of my list is Bob Dylan, hands down. If I could open for him, I think I could just die in peace.
So you do all originals for the most part. Have you ever covered like a Dylan song?
So I do covers. Actually, at the end of every show, it's not a Dylan song, but it's a Mahalia Jackson song called Elijah Rock. And I close out the night with my own arrangement of that.
Oh, my God. I love that song.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So I know you're a musician. Don't want to sing on command at 9 o'clock in the morning, but a little line from Elijah Rock,
sure.
Possible?
Sure. Sure. Satan is a liar and a conjurer too. And if you don't watch out, he'll come to you. If I could, I surely would stand on the rock where Moses stood, Lord. Elijah Rock. And then it takes off from there.
Whoa. All right. I have my Sunday morning chills on this Wednesday morning. Liz Brazier, I want to thank you so, so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to hear more from Liz Brazier. She is now on tour for her latest EP. It is called Outcast. It was released in April. And again, you can check out her Atlanta show. That's on June 17th at the City Winery. There's a lot more information at gpbnews.org.